Mr. Macmillan, Reel 9. You mentioned Christmas dinner on the ship, Mr. Macmillan.
Yeah.
Was it similar to the army? Did the officers serve you?
Well, I never had a Christmas dinner in peacetime, because the war had commenced before I got to my first Christmas dinner. And I think we just served ourselves. I think it's traditional in peacetime for the officers to serve. But in peacetime, I think each ship had a limited amount of officers, because they had to take some away to man ships that could have been in the reserve, etc. and whatnot. So I think we just done it ourselves, which was good, I think. Yeah, we got a couple of bottles of beer, the only time it's allowed, to the best of my knowledge. And turkey and all the trimmings, etc. We enjoyed ourselves as well as we could, you know. But I'm assuming this would happen only in harbour. Because if you were out at sea, you couldn't expect cooks to look after a turkey for all the people. And of course, we're always at sea chasing these German ships that we never seem to find.
Just before we go on to your actual actions and experiences at sea during the war, was there a Nelson touch still in the Navy? Was there still that string contact with the Nelsonian spirit going back all those years?
It was there, but it wasn't taught into you, but somehow you sensed it being there. You still saluted the quarter deck, etc., when you went on to it. But it wasn't sort of pumped into you. But the Navy's got a tradition that just carries on. You don't know it's there, but it's there all the time, in the background. I don't know much about Nelson myself.
So, war is declared. You've had your experience at Scapa Flow when the Royal Oak went up.
Yeah.
Where did you go after that? What was the usual activities that you got involved in?
Well, the usual routine after that was escorting maybe a couple of battleships and an aircraft carrier. Maybe Norwegian Sea, the Arctic, or the North Atlantic, chasing these invisible German ships, as we used to call them. We knew they were here, but we never actually caught them. And then when we come back after maybe 10 days, we would oil, which is the number one target. You must have oil. You can go to sea without food or ammunition, but you cannot return to sea without oil. So you're oiled, ammunitioned, and stored. In preference from your Captain D down through your seniority of captains, which a view of what we called the canteen boat, that was the most junior member. By the time he got to the oiler, Captain D was away, tied up to a boy, washed down in the crew at dinner. Then the ammunition lighters used to come alongside. Food would come with the little trawlers, etc. And then you would be, at the same time, you'd be watching the fleet, the big fleet anchorage, where the battleships, cruisers and carriers were, to see who was raising steam. Because as you must realise, in Scapa Flow, just prior to when the war broke, there was only two destroyer flotillas. So you didn't have much time in harbour. So you were watching, you thought, oh, it took you about 4 hours or so to oil. And in that time, you're watching which battleship, you thought, no, is it our turn to go back out again, or would another few destroyers go? That was that, and then it was over out into the Atlantic to bring some of the Canadian ships over, we know the Canadian Army Forces back over. And then we went up and took part in the Norwegian campaign.
Before we come to that, you say you had these particular tasks. What was your task as a signaller? You know, you're watching other ships to see if they were raising steam and so forth. What particularly, when you were on duty, what was your particular task
on duty? The particular task was all round lookout, harbour, sea, and inspector, to see if there was any flag hoists which may have been to your ship, or flashing lights or semaphore, etc. like that. But when you were, when it was quiet, you read everybody's signals just to keep the beam going. That was the signalman's, if you received signals, you took them down to show the appropriate officers. That was your main task, both in harbour and at sea. You didn't take any part of the actual seamanship of the ship that was out. But you were still required to, hoist the whalers, ammunition ship and store ship. The only people excused that duty were the telegraphists, which had gone through generations in case they damaged the fingers and couldn't use the Morse keys. They were excused ammunitioning ship. And ammunition, when you ammunition ship, when the lighter comes along with the ammunition, it's put through the deck, through the portholes, any way that you can get it in. But the important thing is you must fill with oil. That is all naval ships through generations. The first thing they do is go alongside the oiler and fill right to the brim with oil. Because as I said, you can go to sea without food or ammunition, but you can't go to sea without oil. That was essential.
Do you recall any early task that you had? Is any particular outstanding task stand in your mind that the destroyer had in those early days?
Well, all tasks are outstanding because a destroyer follows the battle fleet. Now, your knowledge of where you're going is rather limited. You only alter course wherever the admiral, whoever is there. Like they said about this story, it's a maid of all works. By the time it comes down through various lines, etc., to a destroyer where you're going, you're there. The only thing you could do was you knew if it was north, it was the Arctic, east to the Norwegian Sea, and west into the North Atlantic. So, through time, when you had the officers say, steer so-and-so, you knew roughly which area you were going.
So in those early days, you were, as you say, involved in escorting. What kind of, I know it may be difficult this, what kind of an escort would, say, one or two large ships have?
You would probably, in all probability, have the fleet flagship, another battleship, maybe a cruiser, and then your carrier. The carrier always come at the rear so she could haul out in a hurry to fly her aircraft or not. Now, around that, you might have 8 to 13 destroyers. All depends on the size of what you were looking after. Because immediately, the carrier left the screen to go and fly aircraft off. She always took a couple of destroyers with her to look after her. Always, that was essential. And there was always one destroyer detailed off to follow the carrier in case any of her planes were over the side and you could pick the airmen up. That was a tendant destroyer. That was allocated before you left, you knew. But all allocations for positions on the screen, if time was available, would be sent round to each. So you couldn't go rushing to sea and two destroyers would go for the same position. It was formed in like a V, and there would be about think 200 to 300 meters between each, which they supposed an enemy submarine could not get through. The Aztecs would pick it up. The Aztecs would sweep out over because it was senseless sweeping in over. That was a typical screen.
And at the point of the screen, at the point of the triangle...
The point of the triangle, you would have your Captain D. He is the senior officer of your flotilla. He would be there. But he would also... Everyone would have to watch the flagship. Because at times the flagship used to put a flag hoist up. The flagship will alter course and speed without signal. So you should watch it very carefully. Not the signalman, the officer of the watch. You know, if she thought she was going to be attacked, she would haul off to starboard and port. And of course, if you're on the port screen, and the battle fleet decided it would turn to starboard, you had to go like the hammers of hell to get round to get your position again. And the people on the starboard side would have to slow down to get it around to the bearing again, which was quite interesting. I mean, there was a few melees in that, but never any damage or collision at that time. Later on, we may come to that. And then it was just over to Norway, which occupied us for 2 or 3 months, taking the troop ships over to Narvik, Harstad, Namsos, and then going alongside the troop ships and taking the soldiers on board. Now, a soldier on board, the destroyer is like a duck out of water. You must understand. Their hobnailed boots were sliding on the deck, and obviously, there were quite a few were seasick. But they weren't allowed around the guns, otherwise it stopped your arc of fire. I rather felt sorry for them, actually, because...
Was this in the landings or bringing them back?
This was... We'd done both. We landed them, and then when the Norwegian campaign, when the Germans began to get the better of us, and they were moving quite a considerable amount of the Luftwaffe up, we found it was fab. We lost quite a few troop ships over there. And... I'm just wondering about one. The destroyer, I think the Afridi was sunk over there. French was sunk. Quite a lot of ships were sunk. I think we lost quite a few soldiers as well. But can you imagine a soldier with a full pack trying to scramble up the side of a destroyer? It was sort of ridiculous, you know. Some of the poor soldiers we took away in the morning to land them. We went back at night and fetched them back again because they just couldn't hold out. But from the military side, I don't understand what they were doing. All we were doing was taking them to where we were told.
Which particular Norwegian harbours were you involved in?
We were mostly at Namsos and Harstad. That's just in from what they call the Lofoten Islands. We were more or less in there. And of course, the ridiculous thing was, in my mind, was here we are landing troops in Norway, and then all of a sudden you would get a signal, go and chase these invisible blasted German ships again, which I only seen one when I was on the Mashona. So that was life on... We come back from Norway and...
Do you recall the first time that you actually went into any kind of action, firing your guns or dropping your depth charges, whatever it was?
I think the first time we fired a few shots is, now and again you got a few German aircraft who used to come over Scapa Flow. And there was always a few shots loosed up. No, the first real serious action that I would think of was Norway. But of course, if you understand the geography of Norway, you see nothing, and then all of a sudden, over these peaks comes aircraft, with being such a rugged country, you know. And by the time you got ranged on them, the bomb had gone and they were away.
Were you bombarding the land in support of the army in the Norwegian campaign?
Yes. I was reading about, I can't remember where it was, I can't remember the actual area. But in those days, communication between forces was rather dodgy, let's say. Later on, they got it pretty well finer. But you did get called for help. We are being held up. Would you bombard? But what you were always afraid of was bombarding your own troops. Because later on, as we come through, we'll find out how that was done. But initially, it was rather crude. You know, you had an army officer on board who was in touch with his army friends ashore. Could you bombard such and such a road, etc.? And you had to more or less range your own range. After a while, when you did bombard, after your first shot fell, we had our own naval bombardment people that could say, up 200, they're down 200. Or if they flashed a K, that was a straddle. You hit the target. They just ranged it up and down. But that was much later on, to the best of my knowledge.
It's because they didn't have landing craft then. They were just, as you say, you carried the troops in close in and then dropped them. How did they get from you to the shore?
I can't remember landing craft, but I can remember going alongside some piers, which were a bit rickety. I think that probably pre-war they were used probably for fishing trawlers coming alongside. No, I can't remember landing craft. They may have been there, but
I don't think at that early stage there probably were any.
No, I don't think so. And with a lot of ships, let's say, in uncharted waters, you didn't know. I don't think we had any charts. Some ships had, you. Actually, there was quite a few ships went aground during the Norwegian campaign. One or two was were fatalities. And then come the attack on Narvik, which unfortunately we were at sea at the time. Now my first ship had the bows blown off up there. That's when they attacked those German destroyers in Narvik Harbour.
Is this the Mashona that had a bows?
No, this was the Eskimo. I had been on the Eskimo before. She got a bows blown back as right practically up to B turret, so they jettison the A turret and the anchors and everything to lighten her, and she was towed back. She got a little bit of pier in the Fulton Islands, which had the nickname in those days of Cripples Creek, because they were all cripples that was in there, had been hit or damaged. I think she was towed back astern. I'm not quite sure about that, but anyway, she was repaired and she survived the war, as it turned out to be, you know.
Had you any narrow squeaks from bombs or shells?
Well, I think all naval destroyers had narrow squeaks. But to a civilian, a narrow squeak might be a few feet. But to a ship, it could be 100 feet, because the underwater explosion could give you quite a bit of damage, you know. I would think the nearest that I ever had during that campaign was about 50 feet. And all it done was throw the sea up over your ship.
Does it make you nervous when you get this close as that? Someone drops a shell or a bomb close as that?
No. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but a sailor's a sort of happy-go-lucky person. You know, he's got the attitude where if we're going to be hit, we're going to be hit. If it near misses us, well, it near misses us. No, I can never honestly say I've ever seen anyone lose their nerve or panic. Because you must understand, the Mashona then had an all peacetime crew. There was no conscripts. I mean, they had been trained for that. And the conscripts done a hell of a good job, don't misunderstand me. But the whole ship was all serving sailors.
They were professionals, in a way.
They were, semi-professional and professional. No, they never panicked, I must admit that. I never seen a panic in my life.
What kind of signals might you be taking during that coming? What were you doing? What was your duties?
You were on the bridge. And obviously, you were next to the officer of the watch, who's, or the captain, whoever may be. And you may get a signal to change course, change speed, go here, go there. And you just, when you read it, you showed it to the officer of the watch, and he would inform the captain, and he would ask the navigator to plot a course, and off you would jolly well go. You didn't know what was going to be at the other end. Or you get various duties. You have no idea of the duties that's given to a destroyer, the Royal Navy. Anything under the sun. Investigate trawler here. Investigate submarine contact. Pick up pilot of crashed aircraft. Anything, you have no idea that the signals, some ridiculous, some, and if you were going along with a couple of destroyers and you knew someone on board, you could make a signal and prefix it X-48. Now that applied to the watch on deck. That was like signalman to signalman. Didn't concern the officers. I mean, it wasn't very well looked on, you know. But it was done. Because you could do it from the flag deck below and the officer on the bridge wouldn't see you. You know, it's leading to leg if a soldier still on board. Pass a little message. Oh, actually, the flotilla I was in, the 60-sword flotilla, they were pretty well noted there for these little signals between themselves.
And this was the flotilla you were in now, to begin the war?
I was in the same flotilla throughout the war.
63rd, did you say?
The 6th.
6th.
That was... Originally, it was going to be the tribal class. And then, before the war... I think it was the 4th. Then we started off with the letter L with the number, and then the letter F with a number, and we finished up with the letter G on the side of the ship, you know, your number. Who it confused, I don't know. I think it confused our own people more than it confused an enemy. Yes, I was with a 60-sword flotilla right through there from April 1939 to May 1943. I had just over four years in the same flotilla. Which, in 4 years, you tied alongside the other destroyers, you got to know people. Surprising, you know. When you tied alongside each other, you went aboard and had a bit natter or a little sip of rum, you know. it was really a good... we had a good flotilla leader, Captain Nicholson. Very good gentleman, actually. It was a really, out of the 8 boats that started, 4 survived the war. And that was the Eskimo, Tata, Ashanti, No, three survived the war. And the Nubian from the Norwegian, from the Mediterranean fleet. I think they were the four that survived right through the war.
And the signals that you were getting were in Morse or flag?
All Morse and flags.
The lamp, of course.
Yes. If they were received by wireless, you had a voice pipe. Cause the bridge was right above the wireless office, down in the bowels of the ship. And you had voice pipes where you could speak to the... You could tell the wireless office, you know, we're going to open fire. So and Charlie's jumped over the side or something, you know. And when they had the signal, they just used to shout, bridge. And you would haul it up in the little cartridge. You know what they used to have in the shops for changing the money? Well, you would haul it up and just open it out and show it to the... Show it to the officer of the watch. Oh, they've got a system of their own. And believe me, it's bloody good. It was primitive, but my God, it was good, believe me. I don't know what it's like today. But
who would be on the bridge in action stations?
Real action stations, you'd have the captain. Not the first lieutenant, because they were always at different parts of the ship in case the captain was wounded vitally. You're the captain, your navigating officer, he was called the pilot. You'd have the officer of the watch if you could spare one. Otherwise, your officer of the watch, the captain would take over. He may have gone and looked after the pom-pom. You'd have your yeoman of signals. You'd have six lookouts, three either side. You would have one torpedo man, and he could release from the bridge, he could release depth charges from the bridge with levers. Or if you were doing a torpedo attack, which never happened in home waters to the best of my knowledge, I've never seen a torpedo fire, he could fire the torpedoes from the bridge.
So there must have been communication between the two stations, the torpedoes and depth charges, to tell him to pull the lever.
Well,
they were ready to fire, in effect.
You have an Arctic officer, and he's on the bridge, but he's also got phones on, the same as the gentleman down, the Arctic operators that are hunting for the submarine. Now, at his side, he's got two buzzers. And as you come in contact, I've actually seen this done. When the Arctic operator can tell you the range of the submarine. Now, when he gets down and down and down, he gets what comes to in those days as instant echoes. That means the submarine's partly underneath you. Now, the Arctic officer will wait until the ship's gone over it, and he'll press his two buzzers. Now, those buzzers will ring on the quarter deck, and they just release the depth charges out the traps. Or else they throw them over. They've got throwers, and they've got racks that drop them over. Now, it was primitive, but it worked. I'm not saying every submarine was hit, but that was the general idea. Guns, you close all the guns crews up, and when they're all ready, they're reported, and in the director tower on the top, each gun, to the best of my knowledge, each gun barrel, a turret, lights up. And then the gun control officer knows that everything's loaded ready. And of course he's following the target and the director. And as he's following, so the guns are coming around. Ranges are passed, elevation, depression, whatever it is. And then you can hear the little ting ting. That's all the guns ready. And he's got a little, like a pistol grip that he holds. And when he thinks he's got the wires on the target, he pulls it. And there's like a little electrical current goes through the base of the cordite, explodes the cordite, and of course, obviously, hammers the shell out. The gun opens up, and the cordite case comes back, which watching the gunners, they jump out the bloody way. You know. So that's the...
The lookouts that you mentioned...
They're all seamen.
Were they seamen, not signalers?
No. No, signalmen are solely there to watch for signals. But you do watch out and give them a hand. Everyone watches, no matter who you are. Even maybe blokes strolling down on the deck, if they saw something suspicious, they would shout. Because my second captain, Captain Onslow, said, even if you see a tin barrel, shout, because it could be something else.
So you have a yeoman of signals on the deck, the main...
You have a yeoman of signals on the bridge.
The bridge.
In all probability, on the flag deck, where the flags are hoisted from...